Women are peace builders. Women are humanitarians. Women are rights defenders. Local women activists in conflict and crisis zones around the world understand their communities and the needs of the most vulnerable groups. Women are the engines of peace, resilience, and humanitarian response across the globe, and they need and deserve the world's attention and support. The United Nations Women's Peace and Humanitarian Fund is calling on the world to meet the critical needs and support the transformational impact of local women's organizations working to build a more peaceful and gender-equal world for everyone. Join us today to accelerate funding, amplify the voices, unlock the power, and scale up the impact of women who are responding to crisis and building a lasting peace for all. Learn how you can join the United Nations to support women on the front lines today at wphfund.org/investinwomen.
Attention all personnel, please clear the launching area.
Fire, fire.
Oh, baby. I'll give it to you.
That was really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Hello. Welcome to Space Boffins for June/July 2024. Sorry for the delay, but as a space fan, as a fan of rocket launches, as a fan of indeed this podcast, you will be used to it. We're in partnership with The Naked Scientists. I'm Richard Hullingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. This time, a chat with the author of Challenger, a new book on the shuttle and Challenger disaster. And I visit London's Design Museum to explore the long history of Barbie in space.
In 1965, the first actual astronaut Barbie was available. You could buy an outfit for the doll called Miss Astronaut, complete with boots, flight suit, space helmet. And that's 4 years before Neil Armstrong ever set foot on the moon, which I think is quite extraordinary.
Let's start, though, with some groovy music. And this is from a NASA promotional film from 1978.
For the first time, all the major components of the space shuttle transportation system came together for testing. When completely assembled, the shuttle orbiter will sit astride two recoverable solid rockets and atop a giant external fuel tank. The entire system was subjected to vibrations similar to those that will occur at launch. At the Thiokol Corporation facility in Utah, a shuttle booster that will produce about 2.65 million pounds of thrust at launch was successfully test-fired again.
Good use of the word astride, I thought.
I rather like
astride. The
Austin Powers music at the beginning there.
Very groovy, yeah. Well, the space shuttle promised a lot. The reusable spacecraft would transform access to space. It would make spaceflight routine and enable scientists, engineers and even teachers to become astronauts. Well, as we know, that dream ended in a horrific explosion on January the 28th, 1986, killing the 7 crew, including teacher Krista McAuliffe. The disaster was caused by a leak in a joint of one of the solid fuel rockets manufactured by Morton Thiokol, who you heard referenced in that clip. Well, the story's been told many times before. We've told that story several times on the podcast, but we perhaps now have the definitive version in a new book called Challenger by Adam Higginbotham. It's a gripping account of the shuttle program, from its design to the flawed decision-making that led to the Challenger and Columbia disasters. I began my conversation with Adam by asking him how the shuttle first came about.
The space shuttle itself, as it was eventually constructed, was really what remained of a far more ambitious plan for space exploration that NASA had in mind when they concluded the Apollo moon landings. The space shuttle was originally part of a system that was intended to take people to Mars and land astronauts on the surface of Mars in the early 1980s. There was going to be a whole series of nuclear-powered rockets that would carry people to Mars, and that they were so huge that they would have to be constructed in orbit close to a manned space station in low Earth orbit. And there are also going to be bases on the moon that will be permanently manned. And in order to get the components of the rockets and astronauts up to the space station and to the bases on the moon, you're going to need something to shuttle them back and forth between the surface of the Earth and low Earth orbit. And that was the space shuttle. And what happened is that when NASA originally took these grand plans, which would cost tens of billions of dollars, were far more expensive than even taking people to the moon, to the White House and to Congress, they just said no. They just said, this is just fantastically expensive. And we're now, you know, in extremely straitened circumstances. By the time, you know, Nixon reached the White House, there was galloping inflation. The cost of the war in Vietnam were steeply escalating. There were also the cost of the Great Society program, which is the social security programs that have been introduced by President Johnson. You know, the value of money was steeply diminishing. There was no money in the coffers. So they said no. So then NASA had to go back to the drawing board and figure out which parts of this that could exist without any of the others. And so once they'd knocked out the moon bases and the rockets to Mars, and the only thing that was left was the shuttle. And at that point, they didn't have the space station anymore. So then it was kind of, where are we going to be going with this thing? What's it going to be for? And they just sort of reasoned that they were going to figure that out in due course.
So almost working backwards from having the thing of working out backwards how to use it as a way of keeping astronauts flying. Otherwise, the end of the human space program.
Exactly. But then there was a further setback when they went back to the White House budget office and said, we figured out how much this is going to cost. It's going to cost a mere $15.5 billion. Over the next 10 or so years to build it. And they said, you've got to be kidding. You can build a space shuttle, but you can only have... It was less than half of what they asked for. So the whole program was almost impossible from the outset.
And what about the design? I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people about this over the years, and it just seemed, just looking at it, fundamentally unsafe to stick a shuttle with a crew on top of the massive fuel tank with two solid rocket boosters. I mean, before we get on to all the problems that we know have happened with that, the whole design seems flawed. But was that what they started off with?
No, they didn't. They originally started off with a much more sort of elegant version of the design, which was to have two crewed spacecraft. One was the shuttle, which was the lighter, smaller spacecraft that would be a spacecraft that would go into orbit. And the other was a massive crewed booster craft, which would be the size of a Boeing 747. And the two craft would be mated together on the launch pad and then take off together on the launch pad. And the booster craft would then take the shuttle up to the verge of orbit, and then it would fly back to the ground and land like a conventional aeroplane under power. And the shuttle itself would then take off into orbit and go into orbit. And so both parts of the system would be fully reusable. But that was going to be extremely expensive and would have tested existing technology to its very boundaries. And that was deemed to be too expensive. So they came up with what was eventually a semi-reusable system, which is the one that you're talking about. So the shuttle is carried into orbit on a giant external fuel tank, which contains all the fuel for its internal engines. But then the majority of the thrust to carry it into orbit would be provided by these two strap-on booster rockets, which themselves would be fully reusable because they would burn for about 2 minutes and then they would fall away and parachute back into the ocean and be picked up to be refilled and used again. But in the original design, those strap-on rockets would be liquid-engined rockets, like the Saturn V rockets that carried people to the moon. Those would both be expensive, and it would be quite tricky to have them parachute into the ocean and all that salt water with their complicated plumbing and control systems, which would be subject to corrosion and damage when they hit the surface of the water. So they decided that they would use solid-fueled rockets instead. And solid rockets had never been used for manned spaceflight by NASA before. And their use was opposed not only by Wernher von Braun, who was the father of American manned spaceflight, but also Max Fager, who was in charge of designing the shuttle. And they were eventually overruled and convinced that the record of use of solid rocket boosters in Air Force unmanned flight for launching military satellites and things like that had demonstrated a sort of admirable safety record, and they were convinced that it will be okay after all.
That seems to be a theme all the way through the book and the story of Challenger and the later disaster of Columbia, that because something didn't break before, it won't break again, or because something worked, it will always work. I mean, it's always foreshadowing all the way through. You think, you must have been really frustrated writing this. You think, why did they make this decision in this room? And you can see that time and time again with the whole lead up to the Challenger disaster.
Well, that is true, because they ultimately engaged in what the sociologist Diane Vaughan, who dedicated an entire book to examining the decision to launch Challenger, deemed the normalization of deviance, which is that they started out with an extremely rigid set of rules about what sort of damage and failure in each of the components of the rocketry was acceptable and still to go ahead with launch. But as they experienced more and more unexpected failure and damage in the solid rockets, and particularly in the joints in the solid rockets and the O-rings that sealed the joints, they decided that, you know, they subtly expanded what they deemed to be acceptable. And so they, over time, almost unconsciously, began to accept a level of failure in the engineering of the rockets that anyone coming in cold without having experienced this kind of subtle expansion of what was acceptable would have regarded as very dangerous.
I want to just go back to the construction of the shuttle. And it's almost farcical when you describe the situation with the tiles. And these individual tiles, everyone is different on this spacecraft, but tiles that won't stick onto the spacecraft.
One of the reasons that I wanted to write this book was because I felt that the two accidents had really overshadowed what an astonishing engineering achievement it was to build this thing in the first place. And, you know, when they first came up with the idea in 1969, you know, this was to have a reusable spacecraft of any kind that would fly up and back into orbit over and over again with this kind of very brief turnaround time was science fiction. You know, it was the kind of thing that was being depicted in 2001, A Space Odyssey, but nobody had ever seen anything like this happen in real life. And so they knew that when they embarked on designing all of the elements of it, but especially the thermal protection system, the heat shield on the outside of the space shuttle orbiter, you know, they knew that they were going to be pushing the boundaries of technology and it was going to be challenging to do. But when they actually started putting it into practice, it was even more challenging than they expected. And it put back the first launch of the shuttle by years, because initially they thought they were going to cover the surface of the orbiter in these ceramic tiles. But their idea was that they were all going to be exactly the same or very similar. There were going to be 31,000 of them. But then they discovered that the surface of the orbiter as designed was so irregular that just wasn't going to be possible. So each of these 31,000 tiles had to be different. So then they were faced with the prospect of sticking by hand 31,000 tiles that were all unique on the outside of this spacecraft. And once they'd done that, then they discovered that the system they'd devised to insulate each tile from the flexing and movement of the skin of the orbiter as it made its way to orbit didn't work as it should do and actually made them fall off. So then they had to devise a new system of making the tiles stick and take almost all of them off and stick them all on by hand all over again. And so, as you say, it did seem farcical, and that's certainly the way it was presented in the press. So to the point where, you know, in the years leading up to the first launch, the shuttle was increasingly regarded as this embarrassing white elephant, and there were a lot of calls to have the program cancelled.
I suppose the other plus, I mean, apart from the engineering achievements, and I mean, you touch on the main engines as well. You talk a lot about the main engines and fear that they were going to fail at some point because they were so complicated.
Right. That was the one thing that they were all afraid of. They thought that if there was going to be a catastrophe, it was going to be the main engines because they were so overpowered and lightweight and complicated.
So in a way, an extraordinary invention there that they didn't ever fail.
Well, and they're still flying today.
Yeah, absolutely. With the SLS. I suppose the big plus from the shuttle program was this opening up to this whole new class of astronauts. And we've spoken to several of those astronauts over the years, but it's just such a big shift from these right stuff types from the Mercury, Gemini and Apollo program to this diversity of shuttle astronauts in the 1970s. And that optimism, I guess, of just how great this system was going to be.
Yeah, although what you're leaving out is the fact that, you know, NASA diversified the astronaut corps to include women and minorities, really under a lot of pressure, because, you know, there had been a lot of calls and attempts to introduce male African-American astronauts into the astronaut corps and women all through the 1960s. And NASA had resisted this with a whole series of stipulations and requirements that implicitly rather than explicitly excluded those kinds of people from applying. But yes, it represented a real democratization of the astronaut corps. It was both the largest with 35 people and the most diverse intake of astronauts in NASA history.
And I guess in that period from the first test flights to Challenger, to the disaster, it was this extraordinary period of optimism of, or at least in the public, that it was, there was optimism that this had this reusable spacecraft that was doing all these remarkable things, releasing satellites, capturing satellites, doing all this science. I mean, you know, it was almost a golden period, but behind it, this fear that presumably for some people that this was going to go, this was really precarious. But I guess in public, none of us knew that.
Well, I mean, I think that's right. But what, you know, what's at the heart of the story really is this gulf that had developed even before the Apollo program, really, between the way in which the astronauts and the engineers who worked at NASA understood how dangerous the business of spaceflight was and the way in which the American public was allowed to understand and perceive how dangerous it was. And that really kind of reached a peak with the shuttle, because part of the announced intention of the space shuttle was that it was going to make space flight routine. It was going to take place on an airline schedule with, you know, launches one or two or three times a month. The shuttle was going to go up into space and come back down and land on a runway like a plane. And then they were just going to wipe down the windscreen and change the oil and put it back on the pad and send it back into orbit again. And so although, you know, a lot of the astronauts and the engineers certainly understood that this was an experimental spacecraft and all of the dangers that came with that, the public were allowed to believe that it was a spacecraft in which you flew in a shirt sleeve environment. You got up there and you ate your turkey tetrazzini from a whole new kind of 80s style space meals. No more eating from tubes, none of that. This was spaceflight for anybody. And that was really, you know, what was at the heart of the spaceflight participant program when they introduced this notion that the space shuttle was such a comfortable and ordinary environment that even ordinary civilians could fly aboard it without any trouble at all, with only a few months training, which is how they arrived at selecting a school teacher to do it, this teacher in space program, for which they selected Christa McAuliffe as a result of what was essentially a kind of lengthy talent competition, where more than 11,000 teachers from across the United States competed for the right to be the first teacher in space.
Well, let's just backtrack slightly to a bit more of that foreshadowing and the problems with the solid rocket boosters, which are apparent from day one, the first flight onwards. It's apparent there is something going on. But as you say, it's become normalized, and this extraordinary level of risk with this faulty system seems to have been accepted, and not just by the company manufacturing who wants to carry on manufacturing them, but senior NASA management as well.
It's easy to represent the story as if these are sort of reckless decisions made by people who were blithely accepting extremely dangerous components. But that's not really true. When they first detected what they called at the time erosion of these artificial rubber O-rings sealing each of the four main joints in the solid rockets after STS-2, after the second shuttle launch, you know, the engineers were extremely concerned. And they went to great lengths to test and analyze until they reached a conclusion that they did understand what the problems were. And once they'd reached that conclusion, then they decided that they would be okay to proceed. And that is what happened for years and years and years. At each stage, when they discovered a new problem or a new worsening of the kinds of problems that they'd already seen, they did tests, they did analysis, and they convinced themselves that they fully understood the level of risk involved, that they fully understood the engineering problems at the heart of it, and they took steps to address them. And then they proceeded, confident in the knowledge that they knew what they were doing. And the truth is that they just didn't. You know, it's a kind of convenient story to cast these engineers and managers as being, you know, as recklessly gambling with the lives of astronauts. But that's not what they were doing. They weren't those kind of people.
I mean, your research is meticulous. I felt I was in those meetings when these decisions are being made.
But thank God.
But the one that I was most frustrating, and I don't know how you feel about it now, having researched this so much, was that go, no go for the Challenger launch after they'd had this extreme cold. I mean, it's beyond belief when you read and you're, the detail you go into on those meetings, that flight was allowed to go ahead on that day.
Right. And I think that of all of the ones that I've just mentioned, I think that the meeting between Morton Thiokol and their bosses at NASA from the Marshall Space Flight Center, you know, that is the least excusable of all of those decisions that they made, because they were presented with clear evidence that Morton Thiokol could not guarantee that it would be safe to launch. But again, what happened in that meeting is quite subtle. It's not really as clear cut as sometimes it's, you know, represented in TV movies and things that you know, depict the events. Because what happened is that the NASA managers who were overseeing the meeting and were ultimately responsible for forcing the hand of the contractors, Morton Thiokol, to, as you say, go from their initial recommendation, which was no go, to go. They changed the terms of what constituted a decision about acceptable risk. Because ordinarily, if your data as an engineer was inconclusive, then that would mean that you couldn't demonstrate that the system was safe for flight. And so then you wouldn't be able to fly. But what they did in this meeting was they demanded that they provide data that it wouldn't be safe to fly. And they said that the data that they presented was inconclusive in making that case. And so, you know, they reversed the normal emphasis in those meetings. And as a result, they managed to convince the managers of Morton Thiokol that it would be okay to ignore the advice of their own engineers, which was not to fly, and change their minds.
It strikes me all the way along, all through these decisions over the years, they just wanted to believe that the system was safer and better than it actually was. I mean, is that something you feel, or is it political pressure? What was sort of going on? It seems to be this sort of groupthink that this is great. This is a safe system. We can fly civilians on it. It's not that risky anymore. We've made spaceflight routine.
I mean, Richard Feynman eventually said after the Rogers Commission, which conducted the investigation into the accident after it happened, you know, in order to find out what went wrong and stop it ever happening again, Feynman infamously said that NASA was responsible for exaggerating the safety of its rockets to the point of fantasy. And I think it was. There was a lot of wishful thinking involved, but there was an enormous amount of complacency and hubris involved. And the simple fact was that, you know, here was an agency that had managed to achieve the almost impossible on such a regular basis that inside the agency they convinced themselves that they were almost infallible. And Rick Hauck, who was a senior astronaut at the time, you know, said that in retrospect, he realized that by 1985, he had begun to think that they were infallible. This was a result of their not only their chain of successes, but the fact that even their failures had either been forgotten or had been recast in a different way. So the Apollo 1 fire, which opens the book, in 1967, had largely been forgotten. You know, they killed three astronauts on the launch pad during a test, and they felt that they had learned the appropriate lessons for that, and that was one of the reasons they managed to get to the moon 2 years later, is because of the important lessons they'd drawn from that accident. But then when Apollo 13 happened, you know, they almost had three astronauts stranded out in deep space as a result of an explosion on board the spacecraft, you know, where they would have asphyxiated. But the fact that they managed to bring those three astronauts back to a successful splashdown, you know, was regarded afterwards not as a terribly close call in which three astronauts had almost died, but what they called a successful failure. because with their derring do and ingenuity, they've managed to figure out a way of successfully bringing them back. And that's the way it was perceived. So, you know, even the things that were near catastrophes had been recast by the mid-1980s as part of this string of amazing achievements made by NASA engineers.
Obviously, seven men and women lost their lives during the Challenger disaster. And there was a lie there as well that initially, and for some weeks afterwards, because you go into the investigation, the recovery of the various parts of that, that they died instantly, that they died in an explosion. But, you know, we now know that they died probably when they hit the sea, or at least, you know, the majority or some of them died when they hit the sea, and they tried to rescue this situation, which was impossible.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that it was a lie. I think that it was more like the way in which NASA's prioritization of public relations had implicitly allowed the public to understand that spaceflight was much more safe than it really was. They didn't, at no point did anyone, as far as I could tell, explicitly say the crew of Challenger died immediately during the disintegration of the shuttle that you saw in this, you know, blooming cloud of fuel 9 miles up. They never said that. But anybody who had watched the footage that was replayed over and over again on television would understandably make that assumption, that not only was the spacecraft destroyed in a massive explosion and a fireball, but that the crew was killed instantly as a result. But that isn't what happened, because the spacecraft, the orbiter, actually disintegrated as a result of principally of the aerodynamic forces that came to bear on it as it flew beyond its aerodynamic envelope. And that the crew compartment, which was a self-contained pressurized vessel within the fuselage of the orbiter, broke free of the wreckage and continued on an upward trajectory, and then began to free fall towards the ocean, a fall that took about 2.5 minutes. And the post-accident investigation revealed that none of the forces during that breakup and that trajectory were sufficient to have killed the crew, and probably didn't render all of them unconscious.
And then we have the Columbia disaster. You've researched this. You've written about all this. I was screaming about almost at this point, this frustration that another accident, another disaster can occur with this system, which again, you can see coming. And those astronauts could have been saved while in orbit if some simple things had been done. I mean, this clearly wasn't a lessons learned, was it?
Well, I think the truth is that in the time between Challenger in 1986 and Columbia in 2003, the people who had really learned most of those lessons were already in middle age or late middle age at the time of the Challenger accident. And so by the time Columbia was sitting on the launch pad at the beginning of 2003, you know, a lot of those guys had left the agency. And so that institutional memory had not been preserved. I mean, I think that some of the lessons had not been learned and that some of that complacency had remained. But a lot of the reason that that accident happened in such a similar way to the Challenger accident was because, you know, those people who'd learned the lessons were no longer around, and the people who replaced them had had time to become complacent about the way in which the system worked.
What's your feeling looking back at the shuttle now? I mean, it was, we're similar age. It was my introduction, if you like, into enthusiasm for space. So I had a book about the space shuttle. It just seemed a remarkable machine, and that, you know, I remember that. You know, as a teenager, that golden era before Challenger of these just doing remarkable things in space. And then, you know, even more recently, you know, before it was, I suppose not that recent now, when it was finally retired, its involvement in constructing the space station, all the things it actually achieved, all the great things it did, and all the astronauts were able to go into space as a result. And then these two disasters. I mean, what's your overall feeling? I guess it's difficult to condense, you know, it's quite a substantial book, beautifully written, into what's your sort of thoughts about the space shuttle at the end of writing this?
Well, I mean, I think that it was an extraordinary piece of engineering you know, I spoke to some people who told me that had the Columbia accident not happened in 2003, plans were already underway for modification of the fleet to such an extent that it would still be flying now, which would be, I don't know how many, I mean, that's like almost 50 years after it first flew, or possibly more than 50 years after it first flew. You know, that in itself is amazing. But I think there's another question here, which is that beyond the fact that what they did fly was this amazing achievement, is whether or not that was necessary at all, whether or not their dream of flying this reusable space plane was divorced from what was required, which was spacecraft that would put parts of a space station into orbit, spacecraft that could go up into low Earth orbit and conduct experiments or deliver satellites into space. All of those things could arguably have been done with the same old technology that they already had, and indeed the same old technology that to some extent is being used now for the Space Launch System and other methods of doing all of those things that NASA is still doing. So while it was an amazing achievement, it may have been a sort of unnecessary evolutionary dead end.
What an interesting thought. Adam Higginbotham, author of Challenger. It's quite a hefty book. I've got it here, although it's got quite a big section of the back. It's indexed. It's well referenced. It's meticulously researched. And as I said in that interview, you do feel like you're actually in these meetings, and you just feel, why did they make that decision? Why did they? And there's just a series of decisions that lead up to Challenger and later the Columbia disaster. So, I was a fascinating conversation. Great book. I do recommend it. You've probably seen it. It's probably on your social media feed as you're a space person.
Well,
I've seen a lot of it.
I'm looking forward to reading it, because obviously
really
I didn't do the interview with you, and that's purely because I've got so much other stuff on at the moment. I just did not have the time to read it, but it's on my list.
No,
and it seems to be the space fans who've read it so far, who obviously bought it straight away, are all so impressed. So, yeah, definitely one to read as soon as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say, Adam, you'd hear, had a British accent, but he's actually American. He lives in America.
So was he born in Britain and then went to live in the States?
Yeah.
That's funny, because as you know, we've got quite a few British friends who have lived in the States for 10, 20, 30 years, and they've got that sort of mid-Atlantic twang, but he doesn't seem to have
No, I think he said he moved in his 20s. And so his accent was sort of locked in. Yeah. So, I absolutely recommend it. And I mean, I think we're seeing now that management at NASA and across the space industry is much more cautious. Things are only happening, and we're seeing with Starliner, things are only happening when it is safe for them to happen. You know, we saw the launch delayed.
But there was still a lot of criticism about those delays, and you sort of feel, you know, they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't.
But that's the point, is they need to resist that political and media pressure. Only launch when they're ready to launch. It's as safe as possible to launch.
Well, since our last podcast, we should also mention the decisions that have been made about the future of the ISS.
Yeah, so two big announcements, I guess. SpaceX has been awarded the contract to deorbit the ISS in 2030. I mean, whether that will happen, whether it'll be slightly later than that, I guess it depends on the
Russians.
Will
it bring it down intact like it does with its reusable rocket stages and just bring the space station?
Land on,
I'd love
it's going to be...
splat.
All over. I mean, the idea is it's over the Pacific rather than over Northern Australia.
There's been quite a lot of different parts of various space capsules stages being discovered all over the place. Every time I keep reading, there's like, oh, they've identified this and it was that.
There's going to be more and more of it.
There will be,
a lot more stuff up there. So that's due to come down in 2030. I mean, it might hold on a bit more. There's still talk about saving some of the modules and incorporating them into private space stations. I think there will be private space stations, probably be an overlap at some point. And then there's this other news, and I was interviewed about this earlier this week by a radio station, and they were excited about it. I really wasn't. Russia talking about having a new space station by 2028.
I absolutely do not believe that will happen.
They are completely incapable of doing
that. Sadly, compared to their history in space.
They have promised a replacement, for example, for Soyuz since the 1990s, and it's failed to materialise. They are still flying this, you know, almost 60-year-old spacecraft.
And also, just purely practically, they're spending so much money with a war with Ukraine. How on earth? And as we know from images of the space program from when we both worked in TV news, and it was laughable even then at the state of certain facilities, shall we say?
Yeah, well, having been to Baikonur, having been to Mission Control, I can absolutely
it was
absolutely
never quite as fully funded as the impression, shall we say, was given. And I cannot see, with the financial stress of maintaining a war, that they can afford to do this at all.
No, Putin is pretty much defunded the space program. It's not going to happen. It's absolutely not going to happen.
But the Chinese, obviously, that's all.
So that's probably what will happen, is Russian cosmonauts flying on the Chinese space station.
Yeah.
That's almost, I would put money on that.
£50? 50 pence.
But,
A bag of Smarties.
Yeah, not a betting person. Bag of Smarties. You don't get Smarties in bags.
No, you don't. You get tube of Smarties, don't you?
I'll put a tube of Smarties on it.
Yeah. Okay.
This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists.
You can reach us on Facebook and X, or send us an email, podcast@spaceboffins.com, or to Boffin Media. I've just thought you might get packets of Smarties, because, you know, when you stop off at those service stations on motorways...
No, they're M&Ms, not Smarties.
Oh, yeah. Because you do sometimes get things that you would expect in tubes, like fruit pastels and fruit gums wine gums.
No, Smarties are only ever in tubes. You can get a multi-pack, but when you open the multi-pack, it's a multi-pack of tubes. Not that I know that.
This has gone way off piece, hasn't it? This has got way off piece.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of way off piece, an email from way off piece. Far away.
So I won't read it all, because it's lovely. From Peter in Brigalong. I looked that up, how to pronounce it, in Australia. And I'll read a little bit of it. It says, "G'day, Richard and Sue."
Good day.
Peter. Yeah, let's not do the accents. I've always had an enthusiastic interest in aviation and space. After 47 years as a pilot in the RAAF, I think it's the Royal Australian Air Force. And the enthusiasm still hasn't waned. I remember while on pilot's course, I just landed from a training sortie and heard that Neil Armstrong had just walked on the moon. Still remember the excitement I felt all those years ago. I've listened to lots of podcasts, documentaries, etc. about space, spacecraft and all things space. Even watched every chapter of that documentary series, Star Trek Next Generation.
My
God,
man.
And he goes on. Next two paragraphs, there's lots of nice things about us. I'll just read the last bit. Been meaning to do this email for a long time now. Keep up your outstanding work. You're doing a great job.
Well, thank you, Peter. That's really nice.
And he says other nice things as well. So if you want to send an email telling us how wonderful we are, feel free. More postcards, please, as well.
Oh, yeah. More postcards. That would be good. Right. Yeah. Well, as regular listeners to the podcast will know, hopefully Peter as well, we often cover space-related events. And a new exhibition has just opened at the Design Museum in London, which seemed perfect for the podcast because it's called Barbie. Yes, that Barbie, the doll with the disproportionately long legs that first appeared in America in 1959 and was the subject of the recent and hugely successful film. Now, the reason I was there related primarily to one of the dolls on display. It was the Samantha Cristoforetti Barbie that the ESA astronaut actually took into space in October 2022. And that was as part of Mattel's Dream Gap project, after research had found that boys were three times more likely to receive a science-related toy than girls, and that girls tended to lose interest in pursuing science-related careers, including being an astronaut, as they got older. Well, I went along to the press preview of the exhibition. The Design Museum, the wording outside the museum is now pink at the moment, it'd be changed. There are 250 items on display, but I was there to specifically talk Space Barbies with its curator, Danielle Tom, and the doll's role in encouraging girls to aim high.
The idea of having a career, of being, I suppose, a working woman, was present in the brand from a very early date. The first Barbie careers were actually introduced in 1961, so just 2 years after the doll itself.
And in fact, the idea of Barbie as an astronaut was astonishingly early, because I saw in the exhibition a board game from 1963, and while it had what I would say were traditional careers for a woman at the time, shall we say, which was nurse, stewardess, teacher, there is astronaut.
Yes, there were, and in 1965, just 2 years later, the first actual astronaut Barbie was available. You could buy an outfit for the doll called Miss Astronaut, complete with boots, flight suit, space helmet, and that's 4 years before Neil Armstrong ever set foot on the moon, which I think is quite extraordinary.
It is, it is. The interesting thing about that spacesuit as well is it looks very much designed on what we would call the Mercury 7 sort of era. It's silver, and the Samantha Christopher Retty doll is sort of updated, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think Barbie as an astronaut in her various iterations over the decades has not always necessarily been intended as an accurate representation. I'm thinking particularly of the astronaut Barbie from 1985, who is quite fabulous, but perhaps not so practical in a pink lamé spacesuit with puffed sleeves and a ruffled peplum. If you're going to be fabulous in space, that's the way to do it. But yes, accuracy is not always the intention.
Several astronaut Barbies are sort of floating in midair, including the Samantha
yes.
doll, which has actually been into space. Tell me a little bit about that collection of dolls, and also how you managed to get hold of the one itself that's flown, shall we say.
Yes, so we do have a display in the exhibition which consists of the various iterations of Barbie as an astronaut. We've displayed them, we've hung them in such a way that it looks like they're floating against a dark sky. The Samantha Christopher Retty doll was originally a one-of-a-kind custom doll made for her by Mattel, and it met with such a positive reception that Mattel actually then rolled it out as a product you could buy. It became a mass-produced doll. The doll, the specific doll that we have in the exhibition, it's not the original custom one. It's one of the mass-produced ones, but it's the actual doll which Christopher Retty herself took into space aboard the ISS. She was, of course, the first female captain of the ISS, and in her, I think, most recent mission to the space station, she took the doll with her. So we also have some footage playing near the doll of it actually floating in zero gravity through the space capsule, which is quite lovely. So for us to get that doll, to include it in the show, Mattel kindly put us in contact with the European Space Agency, and they were able to provide the doll, and it was delivered to us by hand, still in its original flight bag, which was quite exciting.
How cool. And you've got like a little spacecraft as well. Is that original to the sort of Barbie brand, so to speak?
Yes. So one of the things that we show alongside the astronauts is it's a recent Barbie product. In fact, I think it's still current. You could, in theory, still buy it. And it's a sort of space research capsule. And again, it's a children's toy, so it's a simplified, imagined version of what such a capsule might look like. And Barbie in her, you know, in her overalls is sitting in it, seemingly conducting research. The accessory set, when we unpacked it from its box, came with everything an astronaut might need in space, you know, freeze-dried food, scientific equipment for conducting experiments. And we didn't include it in the display, but it also came with a space puppy with its own miniature spaceship. So again, there's that touch of whimsy.
That's relevant, because after all, the Soviets sent
yes,
up dogs into
yes,
space.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know. Did the puppy have a name, do you know?
Not that I'm aware of, but I suppose, you know, children can give it their own their own little space-themed name if they get one.
Now, I have to admit, I do have a Samantha Christopher Retty Barbie doll, as it was a present from my husband. And as was this, and I thought I'd bring it to you because I thought you might like it.
Ah!
It's actually a key ring.
Oh, that's so cute.
It's a smaller version.
Yes,
I'll take it off.
Of Miss Astronaut.
Of Miss Astronaut. So I was rather pleased to sort of see the...
It's so fun. Where did you find that?
You have to ask my husband where he found it. He's going to be horrified because it was, as they say, mint in box, but somehow in my handbag, the top slightly come out.
That's
but what's good,
cool.
So it means I might actually use it. And in terms of, you know, you've also got your astronauts, so obviously you've got the fashion side, side of things, and you've got a couple of scientists and an engineer there, which I thought actually were quite funky and cool. They had flat shoes, not heels, much more practical.
Yes.
And again, it is a little reminder that not all dolls are all about their appearance.
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the rather fun things about Barbie is that, you know, Barbie in every iteration is always somewhat glamorous and groomed. And I think it's actually a lovely reminder for women and girls especially that if you want to take an interest in your appearance, which is by no means, you know, a requirement, but if it interests you, that is not mutually exclusive with having an interest in science, engineering, technology. One does not negate the other. And I think Barbie is a great example of how certain stereotypical aspects of femininity and feminine expression can coexist with other activities that in the past have been seen as more masculine coded. There's no reason why they can't both be enjoyed by someone.
You must have really enjoyed curating this.
Yes, I have spent the last year and a half effectively playing with dolls in my office, so that has been a lot of fun.
Daniel Tom, curator of the Barbie exhibition at London's Design Museum, which is on until February 2025.
Now, I was sceptical when you said that you wanted to go to the Barbie exhibition for a sort of tenuous reason that there might be a space Barbie, but she was great. That was such a good interview.
Yeah.
So do you want the accessory pack then for Christmas?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. It was brilliant. I mean, there were Kens as well. There was a wall of Ken. And I took a picture of Alan, because Alan was much better looking than I'd expected, you know, the way he was depicted in the actual film. But it's a fabulous exhibition because it covers, obviously being at a design museum, there's a lot on the, you know, rather iconic outfits that Barbie has worn over the decades. But there's something there for everyone because it's about the sets, the little sort of furniture that Barbie would use. It's about the process of going into making the doll and the clothes. But there is quite a significant little, I loved, and I will put a photo of this little space stand, and there's a screen of Samantha Cristoforetti in space with the doll right beside where those space astronauts, little Barbies were. And you probably heard them accidentally, the mint in box keeping.
Yeah, yeah. Samantha's still mint in box, isn't she?
Yeah, I guess that's in the study, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Samantha's still mint in box. So it's funny, I never had a Barbie as a child. I got bought the sort of, I think it was an English sort of terrible
knock
equivalent.
Off, yeah.
Yeah, like Tressy. Her hair grows where you push her belly button and you know, her ponytail sort of got longer. But I think I decapitated Tressy. Pulled her hair out so it never
went
back. So
you would have had like that
her
weird
stomach
bar-
was distended.
Barbie.
I was definitely weird Barbie.
Yeah.
I put pen on it and everything and stuff like that.
Did,
But I do like, and I think the film made me reappraise as well, because I'd always been quite scornful, and it did make me reappraise that actually, yes, there was always this showing a range of jobs for women. And yes, you know, the science and engineering Barbies in the exhibition, I think one's got blue hair. They're all quite funky. One's got blue hair. One's got glasses, obviously, because you can't do science unless you're wearing
lab
glasses.
Have they got lab coats?
They actually, that's the one thing they didn't. I was surprised they did go away from that stereotype. They're the only, I think they're one of the few Barbies with flat shoes. But then that's quite good, because I have seen there were a few years ago, there were STEM videos that got heavily criticised in the UK to try and get girls more into STEM subjects, and it was all about the high heels and the shoes. It's worth going to for all those reasons: design, sets, cultural history, and women in space and science, and seeing those amazing astronaut dolls and that little set of this little sort of space capsule. Great fun. Really enjoyable.
She was great. It was a great, really great interview. And that's Space Boffins. We'll be back in August, probably, with the latest on... We actually have an interview lined up, don't we?
We do. Yeah. Yes, we do.
Okay.
getting ahead of ourselves.
One of the new UK spaceports. And maybe Starliner will be back on Earth by then.
We're not allowed to say they're stranded.
No, NASA is very clear. You mustn't use the S word.
They're not stranded, okay?
Anyway, thank you for listening.
Women are peace builders. Women are humanitarians. Women are rights defenders. Local women activists in conflict and crisis zones around the world understand their communities and the needs of the most vulnerable groups. Women are the engines of peace, resilience, and humanitarian response across the globe, and they need and deserve the world's attention and support. The United Nations Women's Peace and Humanitarian Fund is calling on the world to meet the critical needs and support the transformational impact of local women's organizations working to build a more peaceful and gender-equal world for everyone. Join us today to accelerate funding, amplify the voices, unlock the power, and scale up the impact of women who are responding to crisis and building a lasting peace for all. Learn how you can join the United Nations to support women on the front lines today at wphfund.org/investinwomen.